Thank you so much for coming in.
We're all Kansas now. We're all Kansans now. Hey, folks, here we are.
Do you think that's accurate? Because a lot of political scientists describe this as a time of unprecedented political polarization and partisan sorting. In other words, the coasts have never been more coastal and the Kansas has never been more Kansas.
No, of course, that's right. I mean, I don't mean that we're all Kansas. I mean that what I described in What's the Matter with Kansas in 2004 is now everywhere. And I mean, it's all over the world now. It's funny because that book ended with a long time ago that I wrote it, of course, but it ended with I remember talking to various experts, political scientists, stuff like that, and they said, you know, Kansas has, this is in 2004, Kansas has gone too far. Now the pendulum has to swing back the other way. And what's happened since then is exactly the opposite. You know, you just can't count on these things to reverse themselves. They go until we stop them and reverse them.
And the bottom line of What's the Matter with Kansas was people voting in not actually in their self-interest, voting for policies and voting for policymakers that run counter to what is actually in the service of the public good.
Yes, and that was my, excuse me, now I don't know, I've been jogging this morning and now I've got a frog in my throat.
There's probably smoke in your throat from the fires.
Oh.
Sorry.
Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah, California's on fire right now.
Yeah, sorry about that.
All winds blow through the bay.
So Kansas was my microcosm of America. And the idea that, and the question that I wanted to evaluate then, and that I still evaluate to this day, this is all my books are about the same thing, really, which is how did a democratic society like ours choose in the 1970s and 1980s to sort of reverse course and start, you know, and basically set ourselves on the track that we're still on today, which increasing inequality, you know, the destruction of the welfare state, the destruction of the working class way of life, you know, all of these things that have happened since the election of Reagan. They fascinate me because we've done them to ourselves. And Kansas was my symbol for that. But this is everywhere now, and it's in high gear, and it's alarming, and people are alarmed. At least that's, you know, a good thing. That's different.
Yeah. And not just here. I mean, it's interesting to see Europe kind of unraveling right now. What passes for the left in European electoral politics is slowly imposing austerity, dismantling the welfare state, and creating an opening for this really awful, xenophobic, populist right?
That's correct. That is true. And so that, although I have never been an expert on, you know, the Marine Le Pens of this world or any of those, the sort of European far right, I do write a lot about what's the matter with the left alternatives in these countries. Well, specifically in our country. But you can see the same thing over there. You've got these left parties that don't know what they believe in, that really aren't committed to the things that they used to care about, that really don't care a lot about working people. The most extreme case is probably England, the UK, where you had well, not anymore. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn signals something different. He's shifted course. But when Tony Blair was the leader, and then the sort of Blair faction of the Labour Party, you know, they were determined to put their labor days, if you will, behind them, you know, to not identify in that way anymore. But they're all following the lead of the U.S. Democratic Party, which, if you ask me, has been a disastrous, has shown us a disastrous course to go on.
I mean, how much blame do you place at the feet of the Democrats and how much just on, like, historical contingency? I remember the last column, and by last I mean the last column in your job as the Easy Chair columnist at Harper's that you wrote, was basically analogizing the Trump presidency to the Clinton presidency, where Clinton was really lucky in terms of economic trends during his tenure. They got him reelected even while he was facing impeachment and national scandals. Trump is someone who's facing national scandals and his share of impeachments and presiding over a humdinger of an economy right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you're right that so much of this is just fortuitous. I mean, you think of all of the, we're talking, we started this off by talking about the grand sort of course that we've been on as a nation for the last 30 years. But every time that course has been reaffirmed by the tiniest little majorities, with a few exceptions. Reagan got a big reelection in 84, you know. George Bush got reelected in 2004. But other than that, you're talking about very small victories. Sometimes, you know, when Bush beat Al Gore, he didn't get the popular vote. Trump didn't get the popular – Trump, in fact, lost the popular vote fairly convincingly, but managed to come out ahead in the Electoral College. And so much of this shift has been a matter of luck, and also a matter of elite consensus of, you know, people coming together at the top. You know, say Democrats as well as Republicans deciding that the sort of Chicago school neoliberal way is the way to go, making their peace with the Wall Street banks. You know, these are all things that were done. We didn't have any hand in these things. They were done at a level that we don't often, you know, that we aren't privy to. So, yeah. And by the way, to get back to the story that you mentioned in Harper's Magazine, which is also, by the way, included in this anthology of mine, Rendezvous with Oblivion. In fact, it is the Rendezvous with Oblivion. It's an essay about how Trump has a good chance of getting reelected.
I read the whole thing and thought, oh, this is pretty plausible. So thank
it
you for
is,
ruining
yeah.
my day.
Well, let's proceed to ruin all your listeners' days. So the idea of the story is that what really matters in determining a president's popularity is not, you know, this, that, you know, like his stupid tweets. And I mean, those things are important, and all of the awful things that Trump has done. But there's one thing that is above everything else, and that's the economy, and specifically the way the economy affects average Americans' lives. And the economy is really hot right now. Now, we haven't got to the point yet where wages are growing robustly across the board. That hasn't happened yet. But it did happen under Bill Clinton. In fact, that was the last time it happened, and that was the only time it's happened since the 1970s. And because that happened in the late 90s for like 3 years in a row, that's why when we look back to the Clinton presidency, it's all covered with this kind of haze of prosperity. We all remember it as those were good times. Everybody was doing well. It's because wages were growing for average people, in addition to the NASDAQ and the, you know, the stock market bubble and all that. Wages grew for average people. We are real close to that happening again with Trump. We're very close to full employment. Now, this is, by the way, not Trump's doing. He mm-hmm. just happens to be in there. I mean, if anybody is responsible for this, it's Janet Yellen, you know, the former Fed chairman. But Trump will take credit for it when it starts, when it gets going. And if that happens, yeah, he has a very good chance of being reelected. Now, he could screw it up, too. He's such a I shouldn't say this about a president of the United States, but he's such a fool, you know. Trade war, you know. Yeah, he could easily screw this up. But if he were to do nothing right now, just stop tweeting and just go into hiding, I think he'd have a strong chance of being reelected.
But we also have an economy right now that is continues to be on the path of intensifying inequality. And the Trump administration is aggressively putting in place policies, the tax reform bill, with an attempt to eviscerate social services, and,
yeah.
That will continue to exaggerate.
Oh yeah,
inequality.
No question. And the tax bill you mentioned, that which is, you know, huge tax breaks for the rich, and then the Supreme Court decision just the other day that is going to do incredible damage to public sector unions. And, you know, say what you like about that, you know, that is going to make inequality so much worse in this country. I mean, unions are the key to, you know, the country that I was born into had strong unions. I'm from Kansas City. Unions were very strong there. And it was a society where working class people were often members of the middle class, you know, lived in the suburbs and had two cars and, you know, lived these sort of normal lives. That's gone. And it is disappearing before our eyes. Now, what you said is exactly true. However, what I'm describing, where wages go up, that is a short-term thing. It won't go on forever. What I'm saying is that if it happens, it'll happen sometime in the next couple of years, just in time to get this guy reelected. It will be a temporary phenomenon. It will be an illusion. It won't signal, you know, returning prosperity permanently or anything like that. It's just until the next recession comes along. And the danger is that it will create this illusion that this guy has, he'll be able to go to his blue collar supporters. You remember those massive rallies out in the Midwest and say, look, I delivered for you. And they'll be like, yeah, he did. This is frightening to me because it's like it's the prospect of making a really bad historical decision based on an illusion, on something that is real, that feels real, and in fact, you know, it would have real effects, but that is temporary.
It's because our floor of expectation is so low that basically if people have a job and have a somewhat of an increase in income, then that's enough to make them say, okay, this guy's good for me.
Yes, indeed. And wait, we should go back here because the irony of it is, do you remember who was the historian that wrote about the ironies of American history? That American history is a series of bizarre ironies. First of all, that this is the doing of Janet Yellen, who was appointed by Barack Obama. And second of all, that the Democrats themselves aren't in there to take credit for this. Can I just tell you what drives me crazy? I'm going to take a step back here.
Please do.
For years now, we have been fighting in this country over the culture wars and all of this stuff that's on the surface of our politics, while in the background, our politicians have reorganized the economic, you know, the economic game, have completely refashioned it, moved everything around, and just adjusted it to their own benefit, and made us a deeply unequal society along the way. Well, and also a very a risky society, and a society where terrible things happen, booms and busts, and you have the crash to end all crashes in 2008, or I mean, in our lifetimes, few of us remember 1929 anymore, but you have this incredible crash. And it looks like, and here comes this hero, born for this situation, Barack Obama, the most eloquent speaker any of us have ever seen. A man, here he comes to be elected president. And I thought, I saw him and said, this is our generation's Franklin Roosevelt. We're going to end these stupid culture wars. We're going to get down to, you know, we're going to start focusing on what matters, and we're going to turn this thing around. And this is the end of the era of conservatism. By the way, a lot of people thought this. This is the end of the age of Reagan, people were saying. And look where we are now. Right back to the culture wars again, you know, with a president, you know, getting tax cuts, naming his Supreme Court judges. It's like none of it ever happened.
But it's different from the culture wars. I mean, Trump is not grandstanding on abortions and gay marriage and affirmative action. He's grandstanding on trade wars and immigration, which is a form of crude economic populism, but tapping into something no Democrat aside from possibly Bernie Sanders has really been able to tap into on a national level, which is that tons of people feel burned by the free trade treaties that this country has signed on to in the last 25 years. And there has not been anything forthcoming from the political class of this country to satisfy their concerns.
That is exactly right. But he is engaging in culture wars, the whole war with the media, the war with the NFL, you know, all the stuff, the silly flag controversies. He loves culture wars, loves them, because they allow him to feel like he is the victim. This is, conservatives gravitate to this. They have ever since, you know, Nixon, to imagine themselves as the victims of this shadowy elite. They love that. But you're exactly right about the trade agreements. That is Trump's calling card. And if you ask me, very few people do ask me anymore, but I am very grateful that you have asked me. Trade is one of the things that got him elected, if not the, I think, in some ways, the most important factor. Because, yes, working class Americans are so angry about those trade deals, going back to NAFTA. And here Trump talks about them all the time on the campaign trail. And now as president, he's emphasizing them. Now, just between you and me, he doesn't know what he's doing. Mm-hmm. What he's doing has nothing to do with the problem. The problem with something like NAFTA is that it was written in secret by lobbyists, and it's designed to protect American property when they move it to Mexico or other places, and also to give companies a chance to sue governments if they regulate in an adverse way to them. That's what NAFTA. He's not touching that. He's slapping tariffs on things, you know, anyhow.
But he's doing the political performance.
Exactly. It looks like he cares. That is exactly right. And by the way, this is going to play well unless he actually brings us to a recession, which he might. But if he continues doing these little penny ante tariffs here and there that don't really hurt anybody, yeah, it's going to look like he cares. It's going to look like he did something when, in fact, he's done nothing.
We're speaking of Thomas Frank, political analyst, historian, journalist, just out with a new book, Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Ship. And he's giving a KPFA talk on that book tonight, 7:30 p.m. at St. John's Presbyterian Church in Berkeley. As luck would have it, we have two pairs of tickets to give away to that talk. We will give them to callers number 5 and 10. The phone number is 510-848-4425. Again, that's 510-848-4425 to win a pair of tickets to see Thomas Frank tonight, 7:30 at 2727 College Avenue in Berkeley. And if you don't happen to be a ticket winner, you can also pick up tickets online at brownpapertickets.com or over the counter at local independent booksellers. Full details on our website, kpfa.org.
I think we need to get back to this idea of the culture wars and what it is that Trump has actually been tapping into. And of course, immigration has been and continues to dominate the headlines of the activities of this administration. And we know from poll after poll after poll of those that actually did vote for Donald Trump that fear of outsiders, xenophobia, racism, were perhaps more dominant issues than issues of economic benefit that they might gain directly from Trump's, for example, trade policies. Can you talk about, you know, these sort of competing ideas?
If I remember right, now I could be wrong about this, but before the election, immigration was very low on people's list. Today, obviously it's much more important as an issue because it's in the headlines all the time. But before the election, I was at the Republican convention when he brought all those the people out who are – we were talking about the immigrant crime wave, which mm-hmm. does not exist. You know, this is his – it just it kind of makes me sick to think about it. But yes, that is true. Now, that it's an important issue. How important it is up in the air if you ask me. I think that the economic grievance – mixes together with people's fears, with people's xenophobia and people's racism in a way that is new, that we haven't seen before. But the reason I always focus on the economic side of it is because I don't, you know, I'm trying to think of things that Democrats can do or that the other side can do to fight back against this guy. And obviously we're not going to, you know, our side isn't going to become racist. You know, that's not acceptable. But you could fight him on the economic stuff and you could beat him, is my opinion. But whatever. My opinion doesn't really matter anymore.
Yeah, but that's kind of the debate that's still raging within the Democratic Party is kind of like a hangover from the 2016
primary. Oh, yeah. They cannot figure this out. They right. cannot figure out what mm-hmm. to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are hopeful signs here and there, like this woman in New York. What's
Alexandria
her name?
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Yes. Awesome. She's the best. I'm so excited about that. And by the way, have you seen all these people who are like, well, that won't play in Kansas. I'm from Kansas.
It's playing.
Well, I don't know if she could win, you know, the state of Kansas, but there's a lot of Kansans that Kansas is a very populist place going way back to the beginning. I mean, it was founded by abolitionists. You know, it's a state that lives to they fought a border war with Missouri before the Civil War. This is who Kansas is. And they will in the old days, they would routinely vote for whoever was the most outrageous radical candidate available. They don't do that anymore. Well, in some ways they do. The problem is that insurgent sentiment has been completely captured by the right wingers. Uh-huh. But that's not to say it can't swing back the other way. And by the way, that is the case in lots of places in the United States.
And basically what you're obliquely describing as radical in terms of policy agenda from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is let's send people to college for free, health care.
Some radicalism, right?
Get rid of ICE.
Right.
I mean, what's interesting is the other current with the Democratic Party is basically let's counter populism with respectability politics. We'll win these elections by being well-educated technocrats who believe in sensible gun control and want to protect LGBT rights.
Yeah, well, so that is the... this is you're describing the downfall of the Democratic Party, not because of the LGBT rights and the gun control. I believe in those things,
but it's
very deeply. But
the focus on the issues that don't require addressing the economic order.
Exactly. So they will do and say anything to keep them from having to examine their own relationship with Wall Street, their own relationship with Silicon Valley, and more generally their own relationship with the professional class. So that's what my last book, Listen Liberal, and to a certain extent this current book, that's what it's about. You know, you can badmouth conservatism all you want, and believe me, I've done it for years. But ultimately, you have to look at the other side. Like, how have the Democrats allowed this to happen? How and why can't they fight back effectively against these people? Why do they lose and lose and lose? And even when they're in power, when you have a guy like Bill Clinton comes in as president, he got more done for the Reagan agenda than Reagan did. You know, it's extraordinary what these people do.
He did have the benefit of a Republican Congress for most of his tenure, which Reagan did not.
That's right, but he could have fought them. I mean, there's all sorts of what ifs, but like he was proud of NAFTA. Mm-hmm. He was proud that he got that done, and that was Reagan's baby. Reagan and company negotiated that, but Clinton got it passed.
And he was proud of tearing down AFDC.
Welfare reform, they called it. Yep, mm-hmm. Proud of that. He's not proud of it anymore. Now it's come back to haunt him in a huge way. And like the mass incarceration of black kids, that's just an unthinkable, unspeakable thing. But he was proud of those things at the time. And if you go to his presidential library.
Yeah, I think the interesting case on this front is Barack Obama. Because when he came into office, he represented a clear break from the structures inside the Democratic Party that had been attached to the Clintons, like the DLC. He was the first major party nominee to really coast in on a lot of grassroots money. He had plenty of elite donors behind
him,
but he was doing crowdfunding on the internet in a way that hadn't been done successfully before. And all the potential seemed to be there for a different type of politics. That's not what we got out of the Obama administration. So what do you think is like the gravitational force that pulls National Democrats on that course?
Yeah, the tragedy of the Obama presidency, I think, is and it's something that hasn't been written yet because a lot of liberals and a lot of Democrats can't get there. They can't look it in the face, and they can't see the lost opportunity that we let this slip through our fingers. This historic chance in 2008. I mean, that man had, as we were saying earlier, had the world at his back. You know, and he had economic righteousness on his side. I mean, the Wall Street had walked the world into a enormous catastrophe. They gave him the Nobel Prize. I mean, this guy was beloved. He's surrounded with the smartest advisors. And here we are. Anyhow, the larger problem with the Democratic Party is that they have changed who they identify themselves with, and they've done this over a process of about the last 40 years. And it happens at the same time that the Republicans are reaching out to working class people, specifically white working class people. You know, beginning with Richard Nixon. At the very same time, the Democrats are deciding we don't really want to be the party of organized labor anymore, which they were when I was a child, were very closely identified with organized labor. And they've decided we don't want to be that anymore. We want to be a different kind of left-wing party or liberal party, if you will. We want to be a party of white-collar, affluent suburbanites. And this is the subject of Listen Liberal, tracing this change. And by the way, it's not a hard thing to do. It's not hard historical work to do. They're right out in the open about this. They said it. They had, blue ribbon commissions figuring out how to do it. You know, they let labor know that they were doing this in no uncertain terms. That's what NAFTA was. And that they accomplished that transition. They did it. And Barack Obama, in some ways, he comes into office and you expect him to do these sort of Rooseveltian things, and he never does them. Why not? It's because he didn't want to. It's because that's really not really what he believed in. And now we are reaping the consequences of that. That he could have had another Rooseveltian presidency where we would be on term three for whoever his chosen successor was. The Democrats after the Great Depression held Congress up until 1994. From the Depression, 1930, up until 1994, with just two very brief moments where the Republicans got in for 2 years. But he had that kind of opportunity to set up that kind of historic, a realignment that would last for a long time. And he frittered it away, and now we're looking at Steve Bannon's crazy idea of a Republican Party that is a workers' party that'll rule for a century. And, I mean, that seems insane, right? It sounds like Karl Rove all over again. And it's, you know, these people with these Washington, D.C. types with their crazy dreams. But they're going to give it a try. They're really going to try to do it. And it's like, this shouldn't even be happening.
Yeah. Thomas Frank, we're going to have to continue that thought tonight because we are out of time.
That's right.
Hour.
So where is it tonight? It's at a church.
It's going to be at St. John's Presbyterian Church in Berkeley, 2727 College Avenue, starting at 7:30. Full details on our website, kpfa.org. Our guest, Thomas Frank, political analyst, historian, journalist. His new book, which he'll be presenting tonight at that KPFA benefit, Rendezvous with Oblivion, Reports from a Sinking Ship.